This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Man Who Listens to Horses by Monty Roberts, narrated by Ed Sala, with additional material read by Richard M. Davidson. This work is copyrighted 1996-1997 by Monty Roberts. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books Incorporated. Monty Roberts is a real-life horse whisperer, an American original whose gentle training methods reveal the depth of communication possible between man and animal. He can take a wild, high-strung horse who's never been handled and persuade that horse to accept bridle, saddle, and rider in 30 minutes. His power may seem like magic, but his amazing horse sense is based on a lifetime of experience. Robert started riding at the age of 2, and at 13 he went alone into the high deserts of Nevada to study mustangs in the wild. What he learned there changed his life forever. Lawrence Scanlon writes in his lengthy introduction, "There's nothing new under the sun," the saying goes. And then along comes a man or a woman to remind us that while there is some truth in those words, they also deny the human imagination and capacity for change. The relationship between humans and horses, for example, has been much the same for more than 6,000 years. But in that particular world, there is something new under the sun. And it comes to us from an extraordinary man named Monty Roberts. Dr. William O. Reed, the Dean of North American Track Veterinarians, may also have thought he had seen it all, until he and several thousand others watched Monty Roberts work with an unbroken horse. The demonstration took place in December 1995. At the annual meeting of the American Association of Equine Practitioners, or Horse Veterinarians, in Lexington, Kentucky, the virtual hub of the world's thoroughbred horse industry. A New York-based veterinary surgeon with a Kentucky horse farm of his own, Dr. Reed has worked during his illustrious career on many of the finest thoroughbreds in the world. Ruffian, Northern Dancer, Secretariat. He vividly remembers that December day. "I thought it was the greatest communication between man and animal I had ever seen," he told me. Monty Roberts is definitely a pioneer. In the past, horse breaking has been man against horse, checking his will, dominating him. Monty does something quite different. Beating a horse into submission is less fashionable now than it was even a few decades ago. But there have always been infinitely more men and women inclined to the whip than to the kind word. Horse breakers and bronco busters are friendly, even romantic terms to describe methodical savagery. Breaking horses sometimes meant breaking bones, the busters, the broncos. This was a cruel and dangerous event in the life of the horse and of the first human he ever felt on his back. To the art of gentling a horse, Monty Roberts brings wisdom and a lifetime of observation, along with a new and quite exhilarating sense of discovery. Since the beginning of recorded history, one of humankind's great challenges has been the gulf that divides humans and animals. How do you communicate with animals, especially ones that play a part in our daily lives when we share no common language? Clearly, it's still a challenge. It still matters. The longing for kinship with a horse, for example, is ancient, and in this highly technical age, perhaps more powerful than ever. As this book attests, Monty Roberts has not just set out to change the way we communicate with animals, but, as a result, how we communicate with each other. Recently, thousands of corporate officers, from Disney, Xerox, General Motors, AT&T, for example, have gone to hear this horseman speak at his farm in California. It's a tantalizing notion, the horse as teacher. The lessons Monty Roberts learned from horses may one day influence the way that managers and workers, parents and children, relate to each other. What works with horses, he says, also works with humans. The name of the game is communication, and at that, Monty Roberts is an old pro. He was only 7 years old when he made a remarkable discovery, that you can communicate with a horse by reading his body language and sending similar signals back. He would eventually call this silent tongue the language of equus. He would codify it, break down its grammar. I count it his greatest achievement to show the world that when a horse does this with his body, it means something quite specific, and that when a human does that with his body in response, that action also conveys a particular message to the horse. Now 62. Monty wonders if another boy in another era ever chanced upon similar knowledge. Horses are such good teachers, he says. There had to be people before me. Was this other boy rebuffed, as Monty was most of his life, for trying to learn the language of horses, or was he just ignored? You can put a message in a bottle at sea, but the odds of someone reading it are remote. To know even a little of traditional horsemanship is to appreciate the nature and extent of Monty Roberts's achievement. History has had its gentlers, too, but they have been few and far between. 300 years before the birth of Christ, there lived a Greek cavalry officer called Xenophon, meaning a person who speaks strangely. He wrote a tiny classic called The Art of Horsemanship. Educators with the British Horse Society call Xenophon's observations as relevant today as when written. Be firm, but not harsh, Xenophon urged, and never lose your temper while dealing with a horse. He wrote, "A fit of passion is a thing that has no foresight in it, and so we often have to rue the day when we gave way to it. Consequently, when your horse shies at an object and is unwilling to go up to it, he should be shown that there is nothing fearful in it, least of all to a courageous horse like him. But if this fails, touch the object yourself that seems so dreadful to him, and lead him up to it with gentleness." Here was a man training horses for war, warning riders that aggression, with horses anyway, does not pay. Close to Monty Roberts in his thinking, but more than 2,000 years his predecessor, Xenophon seems attuned to horse psychology. Reward him with kindness when he has done what you wish, and admonish him when he disobeys. On the other hand, riders who force their horses by the use of the whip only increase their fear, for they then associate the pain with the thing that frightens them. Such considerate advice would seem only to make sense, but sense is far from common. Our long association with the horse is like a road that here moves cleanly forward and there twists inanely back on itself. The history of horsemanship is less about sugar than pepper, less about light than dark, less about mindful kindness than thoughtless cruelty. Horse trainers of the Roman Empire seem not to have read Xenophon. They would force the horse to the ground, sit on his head, and tie his legs together. The idea was to demoralize the horse, to break his spirit and will, and more if necessary. Icelandic sagas from the 10th century describe how stallions were pitted against each other, much like cocks and pit bulls are in more recent times. Stallions need little prodding to spar. It's in their nature. And if it's human nature to devise sport and entertainment, then what animal offers more drama and wagering opportunities than the very symbol of grace, beauty, and power? The horse. By the 16th century, the business of schooling horses had taken a decidedly harsh turn. England's Thomas Blundville, for example, advised that for recalcitrant horses, one should take an iron bar set with prickles and suspended from the horse's tail. Pass it, he instructed, between the horse's legs and link it to a cord, so the rider may draw it up and mete out punishment as required. If this fails, let a footman stand behind you with a shrewd cat tied at one end of a long pole with her belly upwards, so as she may have mouth and claws at liberty. And when your horse may stay or go backwards, let him thrust the cat between his legs, so as she may scratch and bite him, sometimes by the thighs, sometimes by the rump, and oftentimes by the stones. The Renaissance, meanwhile, had elevated riding into an art form, alongside the visual arts, music, and literature. Tactics used to create haute-école horsemanship may well have been dubious, but riding became part of every noble person's education. And by the 18th century, some equestrians at least appear more enlightened, more xenophonic. The Duke of Newcastle, builder of riding academies in Paris and Brussels, wrote, "A boy is a long time before he knows his alphabet, longer before he has learned to spell, and perhaps several years before he can read distinctly. And yet there are some people who, as soon as they get on a young horse, entirely undressed and untaught, fancy that by beating and spurring they will make him a dressed horse in one morning only. I would fain ask such stupid people whether by beating a boy they would teach him to read without first showing him the alphabet. Sure they would beat him to death before they would make him read." Nevertheless, the fate of the horse rested then, as now, with his owner. Where proper food and lodgings were traded for equine services rendered, the life of the horse may well have been decent and long. But the horse in abject servitude, the horse beaten because his owner knew no alternative, or starved because his master lacked the means, this was the fate of many. And when not pulling carts or hauling his master over mountains, the horse was often a fierce instrument of war. The war horse's lot can barely be imagined, but best not be misled by those triumphant equestrian statues, or the great paintings of sleek horses under captains of war, and emperors with field glasses monitoring distant battlefields on the plains below. The numbers of horses in battle alone give pause. In 1286 B.C., a battle between the Hittites and the Egyptians involved 7,000 horses pulling half that many chariots. At the Battle of Waterloo in 1815, the French and English cavalry numbered 30,000. Napoleon had 20 horses killed under him in battle, another arresting number. In the First World War, the horses used as cavalry and to move supplies and guns numbered 1.5 million. One-third died. Heavy guns blasted battlefields into gruel. With grooming forsaken, mange and parasites spread like a contagion. Against mange, the army scrubbed and clipped horses, who then shivered in the cold and rain and snow. Water troughs froze. Food supplies dwindled. Desperate horses choked trying to eat the blankets of their stablemates. Horses chewed ropes, others manes and tails, and even the epaulets on men's shoulders. I remember seeing a photograph taken before that war of Canadian officers buying horses from a farmer. It was a sunny, warm day for horse trading. Those horses went overseas and did not return. Save for a minuscule number of officers' favored charges, any horses not killed in battle were sent to European slaughterhouses for human consumption when peace was restored. Even in peacetime, the commerce in horses was often cruel. In the 19th century, it was common practice, and still is today in some areas, to fire or soundly whip a horse to make him frisky before a sale. One observer remembers seeing a poor brute, stone blind, exquisitely shaped and showing all the marks of high blood, whom I saw unmercifully cut with a whip a quarter of an hour before the sale, to bring her to the use of her stiffened limbs, in italics, while the tears were trickling down her cheeks. The italics were in the original text and clearly constitute hyperbole. A horse may shed tears from dirt in the eye, but does not weep in the human sense. Countless horses, though, have had cause to cry. Horsewhipped, horse knacker, horse flesh. The words conjure a triptych. Horse's slave, horse at slaughterhouse, horse as dinner. Look into a horse's eyes, and you will sometimes see their resignation. I find it sobering to ponder an individual horse's life, the spirit he was surely born with, and who or what might have stolen it away. The most traumatic event in the life of many horses remains that first ride. A two-legged creature with bad manners enters the paddock with a long list of commands and the spurs, whip, and cruel bit to enforce them. But the gentling philosophy had its practitioners here and there now and then. The Indians of the North American plains in the 18th and 19th centuries tended to be firm as horsebreakers, but slow and easy. Like many modern gentlers, they used touch and voice to reassure the horse. Some tribes rode mustangs into a lake or river. The water helped tire the thrashing horses and offered a softer landing for tossed riders. What a clever notion! Marry water, horse, and rider. Such insights about horses are a little like prehistoric insects locked in amber. If only someone would chance along and turn a certain rock over, the secrets would be passed on. And it seems that some were. During the First World War, a reclamation camp was established in England to deal with untamable army horses. Otherwise slated to be destroyed, the horses were entrusted to horse-wise young women, the daughters of wealthy country gentlemen who'd lived around horses from childhood. The ladies did as Sioux boys would have done. They rode into deep water where the horses soon became docile. It never failed. Why, I once asked Monty Roberts, do horse trainers cling to the old way of the whip and the spur? Why did schooling a horse gently become fashionable at various points in history only to be replaced by the iron fist for centuries at a time? We were in the weight room of his farm in California with its commanding view of the Santa Ynez Valley. Me writing at a rough-hewn antique table, he lying 4 feet away on a white leather beanbag, the most forgiving chair in the house for his woeful back. You have to understand, he said, that most trainers are burdened with the great weight of the male ego. You walkin' on the fightin' side of me, he began in a fine West Texas accent, put on for the occasion. When you say my daddy didn't know what he was doing, I got horses. You couldn't get close to them. You admit to me now that there's a time when a horse needs a good whippin'. Imagine that bruised ego when along comes someone who can enter a 50-foot round pen with a wild or unbroken horse and by communicating with the animal, win his trust to such an extent that the horse accepts saddle, bridle, and rider. All within 30 minutes with no hand raised or harsh word spoken. Dr. William O. Reed clearly learned a great deal when he watched Monty Roberts that day in Lexington. Let me put it like this, he told me. If I had 25 yearlings, I wouldn't school them any other way. This method is innovative and, from the point of view of potential injury to the animal, foolproof. So-called crazy horses are brought to Monty Roberts to be made sane again, and owners of prize racehorses fly him all over the world to work with their seemingly irretrievably damaged animals. Monty hates this work with what he calls remedial horses, but he loves it too. When he can, he's happy to save such horses' lives, but he's frustrated by the persistent human folly that churns out all these terrified animals. He once described himself as a marathon runner dealing with weekend joggers who think they are marathon runners. There exist parents who freely admit that they should never have had children. There exist horse owners who have no business owning horses. Monty will often fix the horse, address and overcome the horse's fear, whether of starting gates or of being tied to a rope. But the owner-trainer, lacking Monty's patience, will let the horse slide back into old terrors, then privately slam Monty for a job badly done and eventually have to kill the animal. In other instances, trainer and owner may be different people. The trainer may have failed utterly with the horse, and it's the flustered owner who calls Monty Roberts. The trainer then has a vested interest in seeing the horse fail. Must be a crazy horse, 'cause I sure couldn't work with him. Monty explained this sad and chronic process to Nicholas Evans while that author researched his novel The Horse Whisperer, and Monty rather liked the way Evans put it in the book. Often seen as witches, Evans wrote, horse whisperers slash healers, those with the touch, could see into the creature's soul and soothe the wounds they found there. And those who truly had the gift were wont to guard it wisely, for it was said that he who drove the devil out might also drive him in. The owner of a horse you calmed might shake your hand, then dance around the flames while they burned you in the village square. There are no superstitious bones in Monty's body, only sentimental ones. He's very clear that he has no magic touch, no physical genius by virtue of the Cherokee blood that flows in his veins, that he is simply a man who has spent a watchful life with horses. Were you or I to spend a year with him, he could teach us everything he knows about horses. With similar patience and skill, we too could then solve the dilemma of horses who dread ropes or gates. What I can do with horses, says Monty, is the result of long hours observing them in the wild. It's essentially a simple thing based on common sense. There is something magical about it, but it's the magic of an undiscovered tongue, primitive, precise, and easy to read. The silent language uses movements of the body, signs that can be read. I've called it equus. But I believe this is a universal tongue understood not just by all wild and domestic horses, ponies, mules, and even donkeys, but also by other flight animals, such as deer. Once learned, the language allows a new understanding between human and horse. But it doesn't need to be, nor is it, exclusive to me. Monty bristles when people assign him mystical qualities, call him horse healer and horse whisperer. Diligence taught him all he knows about the horses he loves. Monty has started, never broken, he loathes the word, some 10,000 horses at his farm in California and all over the world. These horses are green, absolutely raw. They have never previously been ridden. Monty calls the process join-up, and it's a vivid word to describe what happens. He enters into a communication with the horse that will result in the horse voluntarily, a critical distinction from the past, deciding to work with this human in this new endeavor. Join-up has the feel of ritual or a one-act play. The exhilaration Monty displays at the end is genuine and heartfelt, though the ending is ever the same. I've observed this process, and it's both astonishing and moving to watch. Monty is alone in the round pen, about the size of a small pond, with the unbroken horse, a powerful, potentially dangerous animal. When the horse enters the pen, clearly nervous, Monty flicks a light cotton line at him, but never actually touches him with it, to send him round and round the perimeter. Don't go away a little, he invariably tells the horse. Go away a lot. The horse soon learns to respect but not fear the tossed line, which he had at first instinctively perceived as a threat. The alternative to being pushed away, the horse will come to realize, is first a conversation, then a contract with this man. The key signs then come, one after the other. The horse, still trotting in a circle, eventually locks one ear on Monty, later sticks out his tongue and makes chewing motions, and finally lowers his head until it's inches from the ground. "I want to talk," says the horse. A herd animal now in solitary and therefore fearful, for to be alone is to be exposed to predators. His powerful instinct, the herd instinct, is to join another herd, maybe Monty's herd. When to face the horse and make eye contact, when not to, where to touch the horse first, whether to move slowly or quickly. All this Monty knows, for he has learned his equine manners and grammar. The communication has never failed Monty, though doubters are forever testing him and his methods with cantankerous horses. His equine language, which he now teaches around the world and explains in depth in his book, is coupled with an uncommon sensibility and a richly inventive mind. When I was at Monty's farm, he was working with a thoroughbred called Gospel Hill, owned by a friend of Monty's, actor John Forsyth. He starred in the television series Dynasty. Unable to break the apparently incorrigible stallion, another trainer had hoped to calm him by gelding him, but the horse was still nervous, still impossible. Call Monty. After a normal join-up with Monty, he and his students, working slowly and always by degrees over the course of several months, had Gospel Hill agreeably entering the gate, then exploding out of it. I, never mind Forsyth, took great joy in witnessing that event. I have seen many races, but never stood 20 feet from a starting gate. When the gates clanged open, it was like watching a great arrow released from a bow. The earth at my feet shivered, the air divided to let the streaking horse and rider through. Ever the student, Monty a year ago got the idea of positioning his portable starting gate in the far corner of his track and facing the barn, not away from it, as is the custom. He was close to giving up on one horse phobic about gates when it hit him. Why make the horse run away from the barn, his comfort? Why not let him run for home? As he told me the story, Monty smacked his forehead with the heel of his hand as if to say, "How could I have been so thick?" He's an old dog, still teaching himself new tricks about horses. Curious about the intransigence of horse trainers, I spoke with John Franks of Shreveport, Louisiana, the only 4-time winner of the Eclipse Award, granted annually to America's premier thoroughbred horse owner. "How many horses do you own?" I asked him. "Unfortunately," he drawled, then paused, "I have 600. "Monty's method is outstanding," said Franks, who cottoned on to it a decade ago. "I don't know why his method isn't the method for breaking horses. But he does know. I'm a geologist, and when something new comes along in geology, about drilling for oil, say, we all jump on it. But the horse world is so splintered. Everyone goes his own way, and it's hard to change a trainer who has done it his way all his life. It's like trying to change the tide." And yet, the tide is turning. To understand how revolutionary Monty Roberts's way is, only consider the advice that Monty's own father was offering in his book, a little blue hardcover called Horse and Horseman Training, self-published in 1957 under the name Marvin E. Roberts. The copy in Monty's possession smells musty, its contents unnervingly casual. One page displays a black-and-white photograph of the necessary bits and halters and ropes, the latter, though new, clearly stained with blood. "For the bucking horse," urged Roberts Sr., "fill a burlap sack with tin cans and attach it to his saddle. A little terror so the bronc knows who's boss. For the horse ill-inclined to leave the herd or enter the barn, herd-bound or barn-sour, put your left hand on the saddle horn and hit him on the top of the neck right up between the ears as hard as you can. Where to hit, what to use, and when. Some colts have to be hit more than others. It's all there." Monty's father, as you will see in the pages that follow, must also have felt that some sons have to be hit more savagely than others. But it's important to understand that his thoughts on curbing the horse were very much in line with most of his contemporaries. He wasn't seen as a horse basher. On the contrary, for the gift of his horsemanship to children, the grateful citizens of Monterey County, California, named a rodeo arena after him. In global terms, little has apparently changed in the way that horses are taught and disciplined. Some three-quarters are likely schooled the Marvin E. Roberts way. But in North America, there's been a dramatic change. A headline in the New York Times in October 1993 caught the mood. Bronco Busters Try New Tack. Tenderness. The notable lions in these kinder, gentler dens are sometimes long in the tooth, suggesting that tenderness isn't necessarily new practice on some ranges. Tom Dorrance, sometimes dubbed the horse's lawyer, is 86. Ray Hunt, his protege, is 70-something. Both have written books that stress cooperation and harmony between horse and rider, and the number of their followers is legion. It's almost certain that these modern-day gentlers read, as children, the novel My Friend Flicka, written by Mary O'Hara, and published in 1941, in which a boy longs for a young Mustang filly he spots on the range. A Swedish ranch hand calls her Flicka, little girl in Swedish. What struck me as I reread it recently was how progressive it now seems. The boy's father, Rob, is a hard-nosed rancher who harbors no sentiments about Mustangs, but he abhors the traditional way of breaking horses. It ruins a horse, he says. He loses something and never gets it back. Something goes out of him. He's not a whole horse anymore. I hate the method, waiting until a horse is full-grown, all his habits formed, and then a battle to the death, and the horse marked with fear and distrust, his disposition damaged. He'll never have confidence in a man again. The horsebreaker Rob admires most is a woman, his wife, Nell. She's patient, lets the horse smell her, and then, significantly, it seems to me now, turns her back to the horse, just as Monty will do in the round pen. The message to the horse? I trust you enough to turn my back on you. Trust me, too. Follow me. Under the eye of a human being, Mary O'Hara writes, an unbroken horse is in terror. When Nell feels the horse nuzzling her back, she slowly turns and begins talking to her, stroking her, leans on the saddle and places her knee under the mare's belly as if to mount. And only when the horse shows no signs of fear, only then does she rise into the saddle. Women, more than men, Monty told me, are generally receptive to his thoughts on the nonviolent schooling of horses. He believes that that is because women and horses share something, a feeling of vulnerability. The horse, he says, is a flight animal who feels vulnerability 24 hours a day. It's the same vulnerability that a woman may feel when she's alone in an elevator and a burly man gets on. My friend Flicka offers just one more reminder that some people have, in their own way and for a long time, been listening to horses. Monty Roberts would read this novel now and want to correct a few notions. He would remind the reader, for example, that the language of the wild horse is a silent language. But he admires the spirit of the book and how open it is to the possibilities for horse-human communication. Here is the rancher teaching his son about the ways of horses and how trust will conquer fear. Remember, a horse can tell you a lot of things if you watch and expect it to be sensible and intelligent. Pay attention to all the little signs, the way it moves its body, the ears, the eyes, the little whinnies. That's its way of talking. There is the neigh of terror, the scream of rage, the whinny of nervous impatience. That's a very funny sound. The nicker of longing or hunger or friendliness or delight or recognition. She'll talk to you, and it's for you to understand her. You'll learn her language, and she'll learn yours. Never forget that they can understand everything you say to them. Everything, Dad? This was really exciting. Everything. And when you once realize that, friendship with an animal begins to be quite a different thing. Communication, see? It can be somewhat unnerving driving in a car with Monty Roberts. He wears a national championship rodeo buckle on his belt, and for much of his life, competed in the show ring. When you ask him, as I did, to relive some of those moments, competitive juices bubble in him, and then his wife, Pat, will diplomatically remind him that he is over the speed limit. More disconcerting, though, is the urgency in her voice when she says, on approach to an intersection, "Monty, the light's red." Monty's not just colorblind. He's what an ophthalmologist would call achromatopic. He sees no color at all, but a rich array of blacks, whites, and tonal grays. And Monty wonders now if he ever could have learned the pure, silent language of horses had he not been born with this so-called deficit. The neurologist Oliver Sacks writes with awe and wonder about people with such deficits. Deafness, blindness, autism, bizarre disorders of the brain. He's forever musing on the silver linings and the dark clouds of pathology. A very small percentage of people, 1 in 30 or 40,000, are achromatopic. In his book, The Island of the Colorblind, Dr. Sacks describes an expedition to the remote and tiny Pacific atoll of Pingalap, where by some extraordinary coincidence of history and geography, virtually the entire population is achromatopic and has learned to inhabit their world with particular delicacy and subtlety. A deaf person who uses sign language, a visual grammar, sees in a remarkable and unique way. Introduce her into a room and ask her seconds later to recall the objects and their arrangement, and she will typically remember far more than a hearing person will. It's a kind of spatial genius. What's more, the owners of deficits feel a terrific allegiance to their deficit-defined culture. Deaf individuals granted hearing are sometimes appalled at the cacophony, and if possible, return to their familiar, silent world. Monty was once provided with contact lenses that allowed him to see the world in what we call living color. He, too, was appalled. The colors screamed at him, distracted and disoriented him. He parked the lenses in a drawer at home. "Military camouflage," he told me, "is a confusion of color. It stirs the eye up so you don't see the shape. The colorblind just see the shape, but it also means we see so much more than the normally sighted." When he was a child, Monty's father used him as a scout on hunting trips. The boy could spot deer moving on a distant hillside long before the rifleman, who boasted of his son's eyesight. The American military heard about Monty's unusual skill and wanted him to fly as a passenger in a spy plane over enemy territory during the Korean War. With his eyes, he would not be duped by camouflage. Monty declined. His color blindness, which he hid, by the way, most of his life, meant that as a boy of 12 observing wild Mustang herds for weeks at a time in the Nevada desert, he saw patterns of movement that you or I might have missed. In The Man Who Listens to Horses, Monty watches spellbound as a Mustang mare excommunicates an unruly colt from the herd. It's a compelling story and a book that teems with stories. But perhaps we would have neither that story nor this book had Monty seen color as most of us do. When I consider Monty's accomplishments in the world of horses, the depth and breadth of his personal experience, in rodeo competition, thoroughbred racing, show jumping, polo, eventing, may have no equal in the world, I find myself asking, what if? What if he had not been born colorblind? What if his Cherokee grandmother had spoken English? "I understood her body language more than anything," Monty told me. "She used words, not sentences, with lots of gestures and sounds." Perhaps that training proved useful when he sought to understand what horses intended. Only a careful eye could have deciphered their signals when no one else noticed them, never mind knew what they meant. What if Monty had not had the chance to study wild horses? The first thing I noticed about a wild horse is how wary and watchful and silent he is. Though a domestic horse is far more inclined to communicate by nickering, he's also far less inclined to communicate at all. In a given period of time, says Monty, a Mustang may deliver 50 signals with his body to every 2 by his stabled counterpart. I find it intriguing that a wild horse domesticated will soon start to nicker like his stallmates, while a domestic horse gone feral will soon learn about predators and the wisdom of quiet. In the deserts of Nevada, then, Monty was seeing extremely talkative horses. The desert as language lab. In March 1997, Monty returned to the high desert terrain to attempt what many said was impossible, to gentle a Mustang in the wild. It was a high-stakes gamble, for a documentary film crew from BBC Television was on site to record his success or failure. The afterword to The Man Who Listens to Horses presents my eyewitness account of that bold and memorable undertaking. What if his father hadn't been the kind of person he was? A man of the old school, Marvin sought to make a true horseman of Monty, a chip off the old block. But when the son, at 7 years of age, showed no faith in that philosophy and already looked to be going his own way with horses, the father turned on him. Talk to Monty for a time, get a little close to him, and he will often twist conversations back to his father. The wound is still raw. His father didn't beat traditional horsemanship into him, he beat it out of him. Where Monty was walking, in any case, his father caused him to run. Monty Roberts has many stories, and often they made me laugh. Stories about elaborate pranks at the farm, about cowboy characters named Wendell and Doc, Slim and Slick, about calamitous cattle roundups that pretty near killed him. But since he survived, became amusing anecdotes, fodder for a book. He has deep pockets full of stories about horses, like the well-named Prince of Darkness, who literally ran over Monty several times while Monty puzzled through the stallion's starting gate phobia. About his days as a child prodigy in the show ring and on Hollywood film sets. He draws his life and times with a fine and detailed pen. His memory for racehorse pedigrees and for the character and personality of horses he has known is staggering. But many of the stories about his father were gut-wrenching to bear witness to. The telling sapped him, left him wet-eyed and trembling. A bear, I thought, in need of a hug. When I first shook Monty's hand at the airport in Santa Barbara, mine disappeared in his, and I was secretly glad to get it back. Later that day, I watched as he worked on stretching a rope, tying one end to an elm tree on his lawn and the other to his truck. And for all his thick, strong hands, the fingers nimbly worked the ropes. Monty's squarely built, and at 240 pounds on a 5-foot-10-inch frame, much heavier than he looks. He favors checkered shirts, blue jeans, and that belt buckle the diameter of a grapefruit, a brown and black oilskin jacket, maybe a ball cap or straw cowboy hat, cowboy boots. There's a line across his nose, white above, brown below, that says he always wears a hat in the sun. When he bends down to pluck something off the ground, he genuflects like an altar boy. After all the beatings he took as a child, after all his rodeo days riding bulls and wrestling steers, his back will have it no other way. In 1981, he endured lower back surgery so radical that walking again was offered only as a possibility. His riding days were over. The surgeons reckoned wrongly. I have not encountered a tougher specimen of a man, mentally or physically. I wondered if his bones might be made of mesquite, that notoriously heavy wood of the Southwest. He's tireless, always relentlessly focused on the task at hand, and possessed by a deep work ethic. He was a worker, Monty once said of a writer friend who had earned the ultimate compliment. He's not without a sense of fun, or showmanship for that matter. On a long train ride, he's someone I would want for company. Smart, thoughtful, passionate, and meddlesome. Full of opinions, full, as I say, of stories. But he does seem ruled overall by a high seriousness and missionary zeal. His calling has always been to make the world a better place for the horse. His son, Marty, who once signed a birthday card to his father, "Your son, Marty R. Roberts," called his father on the car phone one day, and I heard Marty ask him, "Why are you so somber?" "I'm always somber," came the reply, and Monty, who loves his son dearly, laughed as heartily as I ever saw him laugh in all the time we were together. Sometimes a father sees his son in a certain light and chuckles at the resemblance. Key to his health are the 14 natural supplements he takes daily to compensate for a lifetime of pain that elevated his adrenaline levels and damaged his pancreas, spleen, liver, and kidneys. He takes a natural enzyme to carry oxygen to the tissues, vitamins C and E, ginseng, magnesium, zinc, and melatonin, along with a coated aspirin to thin the blood, all contained in a little black suitcase. Call it a modern diet. And yet, like many horse people, he loves tradition and fine old things, hates plastic and modern gadgets built to break, loves wood, admires craft, and surrounds himself with it. Those 600-year-old church doors in the stone wall by the house, he says, will still be glorious when his Lincoln Continental is rust. The ladder-back chairs in the living room, he tells me, were made by craftsmen who studied their art for years before ever making a chair. The drawers I keep my clothes in are 400 years old, with dovetail corners and hand-sawn boards. There's beauty in that, and you can't find it in modern things. The patience, love, and care that he admires in the work of craftsmen are the same values that he brings to his work with horses. Monty's a proud cook, who often uses his great-grandfather's black cast-iron skillets that hang on one wall of the ample, skylit kitchen. And in the saloon he built by the garage is a blackened chrome cook stove from Elmira, Ontario, an old gray spool-to-spool royal typewriter that once belonged to John Steinbeck, and a framed photograph of Geronimo over the chief's rifle. Notched into the stock in an inverted braille-like code is the Apache chief's name, along with dozens of other dots to spell the word men. Each dot a recorded kill. When I first saw Monty Roberts, he looked vaguely familiar. During the 1970s, he'd been in dozens of commercials, drinking Coke, driving a Chevy, about to sip a Miller Lite. But when you read his book, it's not his perhaps familiar face you should have in your head, but the sound of his voice. I've noticed that people who work around horses and cattle often speak slowly, as if the pace of a walking steer or quarter horse had come to guide their speech. And he always speaks distinctly, with more drawl than I imagined a Californian would ever possess. He's an educated, articulate man. His schooling is grounded in the practical world. Agribusiness, biology, psychology. When he speaks with great purpose. Seldom does he falter in his phrasing, restart a sentence or story. He will take deep breaths or pause as necessary, and for comic effect, dip into a repertoire of accents. I have the sense that Monty Roberts is a reasonably happy and contented man. His is the joy of someone who knew to follow his passion when he was 7 years old, come hell, come high water. Horses, he says, are my blood, my lifeline. But he does talk about a lifetime of rejection. People only began to heed in recent years what he had been saying for so many, that you can communicate with horses, win their trust, school them without whips and spurs. You wouldn't be holding in your hand the man who listens to horses had Elizabeth II, Queen of England, not read an article in a horse magazine about Monty Roberts. He might still be a minor draw at horse shows, a literal voice in the wilderness, had Elizabeth II not heard about him and invited him to demonstrate his horsemanship at Windsor Castle in 1989. The royal stamp of approval. Warm endorsement would be more accurate because the Queen's horses are now all trained Monty's way. Bestowed immediate and international legitimacy. And by the way, said Her Majesty, you should write a book about your discovery. Since then, Monty has met with the Queen on 20 other occasions. He seems as protective of her privacy as he is plainly delighted by her company. They often converse alone in the palace garden, sometimes for hours, about horses, people, the philosophy of education. More than that, he will not say. This was the only time he was ever guarded when I asked him a question. It's an amazing relationship, says Monty, who also calls the Queen Mother one of the most humane beings ever to walk the face of the earth. But Monty Roberts was not the first American horseman to be summoned to the palace. More than a century ago, another gentler, John Solomon Rary, took the European horse world by storm just as Monty did, and he too had turned his back on conventional horse breaking. He also wrote a little book. The copy I read in the rare books section of the Toronto Reference Library was 4 inches by 7 inches. The Farmer's Friend, containing Rary's horse secret, with other valuable receipts and information. Rary's secret? One breathtakingly simple governing principle. You need not abuse a horse to earn his cooperation. Rary, I think, would be astonished at what Monty Roberts and the new tribe of gentlers can accomplish. But for me, the striking thing about Rary was how his ideas mirror those of Monty and the moderns, and Xenophon and the ancients. Rary had farmed in Ohio, and there wisely sought the advice of old cowpunchers, circus trainers, Indian riders, and any horseman with answers to his questions. Eventually, he devised a system of training horses that relied on gentleness, fearlessness, and simple devices, such as soft leather hobbles that worked even on hostile horses. He made a name for himself. In time, despite several tests put to him by disbelieving trainers and horsemen, he arrived in England. There he faced a stallion called Cruiser, a steeplechaser not ridden in 3 years, and who wore an 8-pound iron muzzle. His groom always carried a bludgeon. Cruiser's owner, Lord Dorchester, conceded that it was as much as a man's life was worth to attend to him. But attend to him Rary did, showing infinite patience, perseverance, and savvy. He gentled the horse, forced him to lie down, talked softly to him, and touched him all over. He set to work, as one observer put it, to tame him limb by limb and inch by inch. Any show of hostility would prompt Rary to lift the horse's head and shake it, as a father would scold a daughter by lightly grabbing her chin. Cruiser, the crazy horse, would be calmed. Word spread. Rary taught cavalry officers and riding masters. He lectured London cabmen on treating horses humanely. Queen Victoria had Rary tame one of her more fiery horses, and the Prime Minister, Lord Palmerston, sought a word. A contributor to the Illustrated London News in 1858 predicted, wrongly, of Rary that his name will rank among the great social reformers of the 19th century. Instead, his little book, The Farmer's Friend, was forgotten. But clearly he'd sketched there a kind of gentler's guide to the equine galaxy. Appeal to the horse's intelligence, he urged. Let the laws of his nature rule your thinking. Use a system. Haste makes waste. Leave fear and anger behind. There is about the Roberts farm an air of quiet solidity. Fear and anger have no place here. You must ascend a winding road to achieve the low-slung, board-and-batten, and adobe house. A rough-looking, mesquite-wood wagon, called a stone boat, and once pulled by oxen to haul rocks, is the first thing you see as you approach the house. Set on an elevated island of lawn surrounded by a low stone wall, the great wagon, a clear centerpiece, at night is bathed in floodlight. Ceilings on the house's south side are all high, and windows there equally high. The honeyed light from California's skies pours in day after day. From up here, one has a commanding view of many horses in their paddocks below. If it sounds restful, it is. By day, the light warmed my northern soul. My first night there, the frogs commenced their chorus, and I admired the fireflies down in the valley. Then Pat Roberts kindly set me straight. The fireflies were the headlights of cars on the road, their beams broken by the trunks of 30-foot cedars that line the edges of flag-as-up farms. The blinking lights are like a pulse. "We don't run the farm," Monty and Pat's daughter Laurel once told me on the fly. "The farm runs us." When the farm office shuts down after business hours, calls are routed to the house and start every morning at 6:30. The patio and terraced lawns overlooking the valley are protected by an Alamo-like wall on the west, with inset doors that open to let in sea breezes and a view of the sun as it drops below the mountains. In that wall, in its own grotto, is a statue of St. Francis of Assisi, the patron saint of animals. Monty smiled when I asked him about the statue. A good choice, he conceded, but not one picked with any solemnity. A stone Dr. Doolittle might also have done the trick. Perhaps Monty's greatest gift to us will be his heartfelt plea that we all can and should talk to the animals. On that lawn where St. Francis, bird in hand, casts his gaze, Monty learned, using precisely the methods he used to communicate with horses, to talk to wild deer. Even does and newborn fawns, once he's made his introduction, abide his close proximity. Monty's work with deer began in 1977, when he was riding in the hills overlooking the farm and chanced upon an old wounded doe being attacked by coyotes. That rescue of the deer he would call Grandma paid handsome dividends. Monty devotes an entire chapter to his experience with deer, in part because deer use the same body language as horses, and they taught him many surprising subtleties. You may finish that fascinating section in the book, as I did, with a new respect and appreciation for Grandma and her kin. When I was at the farm, a young antlered male called Cyrus came up the hill every morning to have his neck rubbed. Doors must be closed when he's about, for he will now wander inside the house as if it were his. Simply put, Monty communicates with deer by deploying an advance-and-retreat, hello-and-goodbye system that draws on most animals' conflicting tendencies. First to flee an apparent threat, then, out of curiosity, to investigate it. A horse, for example, feels security in numbers. Isolate him, and he will want to join up with another creature, even a human, any port in a storm, if the trust is there. While fly fishing, his favorite pastime is to go fly fishing in northern British Columbia, always catch and release. Monty noticed that fish, like deer and horses, initially fled him and then circled back in the stream. You can talk to the animals, and we do. A recent study at the University of Pennsylvania found that 98% of pet owners talk to their animals, as if to a sympathetic friend. Convinced there is more there than meets the eye, those of us who own dogs or cats or horses have grown increasingly fascinated with the inner lives of these and other animals. How else to explain the extraordinary success of When Elephants Weep, The Emotional Lives of Animals by Jeffrey Musayef Mason and Susan McCarthy, or The Hidden Life of Dogs by Elizabeth Marshall Thomas, or The Intelligence of Dogs by Stanley Coren? Nicholas Evans's novel, The Horse Whisperer, was one of the memorable publishing successes in the mid-1990s. The story in a nutshell. A magazine editor from New York embarks on a quest to Montana, where she desperately hopes a horse whisperer can heal her teenage daughter's horse, crazed and badly scarred after a highway accident. Somehow the mother intuits Healing the horse is the key to healing her distraught and now partially disabled daughter, even to healing herself. The Whisperer is a character inspired by Evans's long conversations with Monty Roberts, Tom Dorrance, Ray Hunt, Buck Brannaman, and others. The Horse Whisperer is a novel about hope, but mostly it's a novel about horses and connecting with horses. I don't do it for the people, the Whisperer explains. I do it for the horse. Sift through the words of actual gentlers, and you hear echoes. Gentlers talk, not about people with horse problems, but about horses with people problems, about the horse's teacher, about the slow way with horses as the quickest way. This is a horse-centered worldview that gentlers say offers a nice spin-off. It makes humans more humane. Horses, creatures of flight, are so sensitive and aware. Humans, more inclined to fight, have lost that acuity. The horse has much to teach humans about listening. In the span of human-animal interaction, our position, until quite recently, has been either utilitarian, how can I exploit this animal, or egomaniacal. Don't I look handsome, tall, successful on this fine gray horse? Up until 10 or 20 years ago, most doctors believed that newborn infants neither felt nor remembered pain. No need, then, to use analgesics for painful.